Greetings, humans, living and dying in the Anthropocene. This is Jamming Their Transmission, where rebels, freaks, critics, dissidents, iconoclasts, and oddballs live. I'm your fellow traveler, John Madero. This is Jamming Their Transmission. I'm John Madera. The Association of Writers and Writing Programs Conference and Book Fair, colloquially known as AWP, is an annual destination for writers, editors, publishers, teachers, and students. The conference features over 2,000 presenters and over 500 readings, panels, and lectures. The book fair features over 800 presses, journals, and literary organizations from around the world. AWP is taking place in Portland, Oregon this year, March 27th through the 30th. I won't be there this year, alas, but today I'm happy to host a podcast of readings from a number of great writers who also won't be attending AWP this year, including Rose Hunter, Rebecca Entel, Paul Beckman, Davis Schneiderman, and Michael Martone.
Hi, my name is Rose Hunter, and I'll be reading one of my Las Vegas poems, Water. Water. A dark cloud hangs, but if rain falls, it evaporates before it hits, while millions of toilets flush, sink, drain. The shutter shake, release, repeat of sprinklers in Summerlin and Green Valley golf courses suck it up. Our banter over the starburst, where I bit my cheek, that ridgeline I run my tongue over, in the city named after what is not here anymore. The mesquite groves, willows, cottonwoods and saltgrass that grew once, maybe even in our barren yard, the spinach, rice grass, chia, broom rape, screw bean, devil's claw, blazing star, not so long ago. Tales of water grabs and reclamation acts, water buffaloes, hairy-eared and glinting in the shadows, like the shrub ox did here once. What will our descendants, if any, descend to? At Lake Mead, cobalt, blue rider, and Klein blue, to leap, I say, into the void, arms outstretched, back arched, the beginning of a doomed swan dive. You, me, the lake keeps us all alive somehow. I read about it, but that doesn't tell me how. My inability to comprehend scale, you say. The solution to pollution is dilution, the water people say. And after all, people, fish, swim, water ski, DDT, PCB, heavy metals, ammonium perchlorate, endocrine disruptors, scrambled instructions, eunuch fish, frankenfish, gaps, punctuations, watts, switcheroo, thinking of you under the shower, shaking your head, your cheeks, train-like rumbling, full body sighing, snorting, delighting. For this I call you true hedonist and some sort of note to self. An oasis, too, is a convergence of opposites, like plankton and the whale. A drop of sweat into Lake Mead, the subsidence and rebound jet, the circular, symboling waves. They say the ultimate water crisis is not here, and won't get here, not ultimately, but it will ultimately happen, but it keeps getting pushed back, ultimately, like a Teflon politician, but you know there must come a day. But how we love to leap, splash, somersault, round and round, scanning for flashes of fool's gold and the form of small remedies, ways you can help, and other clever, we thought, bargainings, into the dark turning, we never wanted to come back in.
Hello, my name is Rebecca Entel, and I'll be reading from my novel, Fingerprints of Previous Owners. At night, the speakers and the sawing would fall away, but the sounds of Furnace Island would keep the hotel guests alert. The whoosh of the waves, a sound that was supposed to put them to sleep but was called a roar. After a night or two, they'd dream through everything. Archipelago, the maps in their rooms would tell them. Scattered seeds floating away from the finger of Florida, that imperative pillar to our point of exclamation. A tiny island way out from any mainland, quivering like an unattached period in the water, seemed like an invitation to decide how to complete the sentence that had brought them here. Sentences started elsewhere. We were just a dot named twice, neither time by us. They would hone their geographical grammar, tracing the explosion of islands across the map's flat sea. Or they would turn away, be no place. The rooms would be full of no one's history, never belonging to anyone. They would end up sitting by the pool most of their days at the resort, reaching out for drinks on trays, flipping through magazines, maybe forgetting the books they'd brought. Most of them would never swim. Those who did would dip in the pool, never the ocean. Their loungers would face in toward the pool in the hotel, never out to sea. Some would do laps, strapped with full snorkeling equipment, back and forth, slow-motion lawnmowers, finally emerging like primordial creatures with the baggy seats of their bathing suits leaking water down their legs. Plastic masks and the snakes of their snorkels like plumbing for their heads. The soupy words they called out to the staff would sound like complaints or warnings. They would eventually discover that the sawing was the sound of the maids sweeping crabs from the deck with wire brooms, back onto the sand to scuttle in loops down to the beach or into the truck parking lot. I was one of the maids they heard but didn't see, sweeping away, by day. By night, I swooped with gravity like a ghost was crocheted around my arm, the machete its extension, not hacking away like a crazy bitch. My brother Troy did that. He couldn't be taught, Mother used to say, and she had been a teacher. He was the bad one, the one who left her for work in the capital on Wells Island and wouldn't ever be coming back. I was the good one, the one who came home every night bringing money. I was the one who would never leave. She had no idea I went where I wasn't supposed to go, wandered along the stones that peaked from the earth like calluses hardened from time, slicing a path big enough only for me, not caring if the nettles picked at my work uniform, which would cost us money when it had to be replaced. Sliced and climbed and grubbed and tiptoed around anthills to walk inland among the dead. Those are not our bones, she would have said to me. She would not have meant people. She would have meant the ruins of the slave plantation, the stone walls creeping up within the brush, which led nowhere, which told you nothing, which were built only to keep in. I knew. I had followed them. I didn't know what I was looking for. Mother loved the knowing. Knowing Bayard, a third of a mile down the road in the lime green house, could fix your car. We didn't have a car, but Mother knew Bayard could fix it if we got one. And she liked knowing exactly how far it was to walk if someone else broke down in front of our house. Knowing a whistle in the air meant heavy was coming around the bend. Knowing her hair'd be some shade of red you'd never find growing in your garden. Knowing Miss Patrice's store would always reopen after lunch and would always have ibuprofen when you couldn't find it anywhere else. Garrett would always stop by when he'd been catching crabs, and we'd always eat well each night that he did. Miss Minnie would ask every time I saw her if Mother would join her in selling at the straw market that coming Wednesday or singing at church that coming Sunday, and the answers would always be yes and no. Knowing her brother, my Uncle Q, lived as far from us on this island oval as you could get, but he wouldn't go 3 days without seeing on her. And Mother knew I'd wash all the plates if she'd grab a needle to fix up the edges of my work apron until her hand was too stiff and came to rest in her lap, a knobby cavern. She didn't wonder how it got torn up, because she hadn't been inside the resort to see they'd cleared away the brush, so you'd walk through the entire stretch of the place without anything touching you. For all she knew, my uniform got snagged all day at work. Hallback, we called those nettled plants. They dug into your skin and your clothes when you tried to get by, hauled you back.
Hi, my name is Paul Beckman, and I'm going to read the flash fiction story entitled, Who Knew? Who Knew? This morning I watched my neighbor go off to work. She lives in the brownstone across the alley, second floor side, directly across from my side through. Every morning I watch her go off to work, after I watch her having coffee and toast, standing at the kitchen sink while wearing her slip. The slip is always white. Before she has her breakfast, she's in her bedroom looking through her closet, deciding what to wear for the day. And before that, she's drying herself off from her morning shower. When she rubs her hair dry, her breasts jiggle. And after she's dried off, and before she goes to her closet, she puts on her panties and bra. She wears only white underwear. And while the panties are skimpy, she doesn't wear thongs. Then she puts on her slip. Prior to her drying herself in her bedroom, I watch her brush her teeth and then step into the shower. She showers quickly. Sometimes she shaves her legs, putting one at a time on the toilet. She's a no-nonsense shaver with her electric razor, which she also uses to shave her underarms. She faces the window when she does this. Then, I have to rush off to get to work. I get in about a half hour after my neighbor, who is the receptionist for the office I work in. We always say hello to each other. Well, I say hello, and she says good morning. That's the extent of our interaction for now. And I'm hoping to turn it into a bit more of a conversation, which could then possibly lead to lunch, and then perhaps sometime down the road, after work drinks. Today at lunch hour, for the first time ever, we were alone on the elevator, both facing front, when she asked if I could possibly do her a favor. And I said I'd try, and I would if I could. And she then asked, in the same tone, if I would please close my bedroom shades at night, because she's spending too much time waiting to watch me masturbate, and sometimes misses her favorite TV shows. The door opened at the cafeteria floor, where she got out, and I continued on down to the lobby, so I didn't have to answer her, but thought it all over during lunch. When I got back to the office, she was at the receptionist's desk and said, good afternoon. I nodded my hello and went to my cubicle wondering if tomorrow would be a good time to pop the lunch question.
This is David Schneiderman, and I am introducing a piece I did with Don Meyer as part of the audio collage collective called The Muttering Sickness. The track is called Bill, Don't Be Angry from our record The Last Days of Radio on the Fast Speaking Music label. The tracks on the record each use found sounds from decades in the 20th century, and this is the 1950s.
Bill, don't be angry with me.
Put new duds in your washing machine. Finest duds you've ever seen. Bigger news now when you sing. D-U-Z does everything.
The new duds brings you The Guiding Light, created by Erna Phillips.
You know, Bill, it's nice to be able to sit down at the breakfast table, just the two of us, and have that second cup of coffee together.
Zoom, 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 out of the air.
Of course, if you had to be on the job earlier than you do, we wouldn't be able to have this, well, I guess you might say this pleasant little interlude.
By the military-industrial complex.
But then when we move into our own home, well, just as you said the other evening, we'll really be alone. And then maybe, maybe we can start thinking about a family.
Hmm? I'm sorry, what'd you say?
Bill, don't be angry with me.
By the military-industrial complex.
Oh, I know how anxious you are for us to have a family.
And you're wrong.
So am I, dear.
Yeah, sure it would be nice to have a little kid running around.
They don't run around right away, you know. They have to be babies first.
Mm.
Do you think you'd be able to get away from the office a little early today? If you could, we might go over and see that house. Mr. Chambers said we could stop in any time.
Puffs of wheat, sugar toasted.
Of course I'd have to phone Mrs. Chambers and let her know we were coming.
You know I can't get away today. I told you last night Ted was going out of town.
Yes, I know you did.
But I'd hoped, Bill, after the talk we had, that you might be able to change Ted's mind about leaving with Chucky at this time.
And I told you I wouldn't interfere.
I know that's what you told me, but... Bill, don't be angry. I thought perhaps you'd... Bill, don't be angry. Sort of turned it over in your mind and... Bill, don't be angry.
Look, Bert, regardless of how I feel, whether I think Maida would be doing the wrong thing or not in leaving Ted, it is not any of my business.
But she's your sister. I can remember a time when you made her welfare and Chucky's pretty much your business. So much so that we had to postpone our wedding.
Down, 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 the stomach through. Round, 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 the system too.
Now, please, don't rehash the past.
Well, it isn't any more pleasant for me than it is for you.
A swallow away.
But I wasn't only thinking of myself and you. Of course, I know I can't convince you of that fact. I won't even try.
Okay, oh, that boy knows I like those new sugar
anyway. And besides, I've
he's got
to
get an aching head.
I don't said I'd be at the office around 9:30.
Have an empty gun.
Please.
Rubinoff and the orchestra now offer for your
Bill,
entertainment.
Don't be
by the military industrial complex.
That's good. Now you be a good little wife and stay home and tend to your knitting.
And here is Michael Martone reading The Sex Life of the Fantastic Four.
The Sex Life of the Fantastic Four. Invisible Girl. Where he touches me, I vanish. The back of his hand, stroking my face, erases my cheek. Involuntary, the skin initially, then the deeper flesh. The skin first, gone when it feels his fingertips. I feel the surface disappear, but still feel feeling there. His touch sinks in, the subdermal layers go, the nested cells he polishes clear, his soft palm hovering. By the time I've stripped off the blue bodysuit, stepping out of the spandex which retains, for a second, the shape of my body as it falls, the body it reveals has already become translucent, the meat turning milky, the bone wiped clear, in streaks like a smear of butter melts the white from a paper plate. I become clarified grease beneath him. Entwined, we are tangled up in the skein of my airy sinew, the ropey braids in my circulatory system, its cartoon of primary reds and blues. My blood thins in the extremities, but knots at the nodes of erectile tissue, clotting a nipple visible again beneath the sheen he has left from licking what looked a moment before like air, now me there, concentrated into rubbery ruby light again. It disappears into his mouth. I'm down to the broken dashes of the central nervous system, suggesting still outlining the outer neural net of my skin, feeding me the synaptic code of dots and dits from the dissipating periphery. His hands, as they caress nothing, reveal me to myself, leave the after image of his movement burned upon the transparent wall of my retina, the lightning streak of his skin shaping the borders of my own body. I close my eyes and watch as my eyelids dissolve. My vision passes through skin first, turning then to scrim, to see now through another unoccluded lens. I see through my lids, through myself, see his cock clearly moving inside of the vast and now empty space which must be me and must be not me. The Human Torch. I sit at the bar, usually, drinking ouzo neat, a Jordan almond dissolving at the bottom of the shot glass. I've set the liquor on fire, swizzling it with my finger. I like to watch the floor show and the show on the floor, the tunnel crowd weirded out by the drag queens doing strip teases were singing old torch songs, one more for my baby and one more for the road, sending up Lady Day or Barbara, that kind of thing. I dumped some water into my aperitif, extinguishing the blue flame and turning the drink chalky, like a participate in a test tube. My current favorite is Eliza Interpreter, who vamps this obscure number, Is It by Mercer, which plays with the line, You've Let Yourself Go. She sings to her lug of a lover how he's grown fat and dull, how their liaison has suffered the consequences. There follows a litany of complaint. What a schlub, she sings, You've Let Yourself Go. But it turns in the end, it always turns. Come on over here, she whispers. Come on over and let yourself go. I tear up naturally, but it isn't the saline staining my cheek. It's a dab of molten lava percolating there in the corner of my eye, my own brand of running mascara. I have to watch myself. Spontaneously, my eyelashes can ignite, throwing sparks up into the tinder of my eyebrows, which can smolder for hours without my knowing. Once I set the sprinklers off in the Russian bathhouse on 10th. I've stopped looking for a boy who can top me. It's too dangerous. The leather bar is too hot. I was cooking inside the horsehide Eisenhower jacket, cooking the jacket, the seared meat smell, an additional turn-on, I suppose. These powers we've acquired seem to fall into the dark space between the involuntary responses wired into us and those we can modulate. Not like the heartbeat on the one hand or walking home on the other, but like blinking and winking, say, or like desire itself. There's only so much one can do to help oneself. Oh, sure, I can bellow, flame on, all I want, followed by the stunning transformation from solid buff flesh to superheated gaseous vapor, the controlled burn. Here, precision scalding, there, the delicate sweating of copper pipes. But it is in the weaker moments, when I'm weak in my knees, a stranger's hand on my hand will steam off skin. I can't watch myself all the time. A human touch sets off this human torch. I am a captive within my sublime hide. Mr. Fantastic. To make the edge of the famous samurai swords of antiquity, the smiths beat the iron flat into foil, then folded the metal over and hammered it flat again. And then another fold and peening, and still another, and then another. Thousands of times, fold and flatten, until in this primitive way, through brute force and patience, the metal's crystalline structure became saturated with itself. Atoms packed inside the spaces between atoms, at last both the surface and simultaneously its underside, now no more than a molecule deep, the edge of the matrix serrated only by the minute undulation of subatomic matter, a sine wave spanning a mere handful of angstroms of the outermost electron shells. Sharp, you bet. It is what I find myself doing to my own skin in private moments. I stretch and fold and knead it back together, a wrinkle in the loose hide on my forearm, a flap of fat at my chin. It is the very definition of definition, and I spend hours honing my musculature, ironing in the pleats on my belly, increasing the cant of my cheekbones with the finest shade of a sharpened pencil line. I know what people are thinking. The elasticity of your normal, everyday, run-of-the-mill, uncosmically irradiated penis is itself a goddamn miracle to most. The way it inflates, its skin thinning to the gauziest of tissues, webbed by the diaphanous capillary sponge, grown thick with the stiffened rebar of packed and interlocking corpuscles. Sure, I've tried it all. Swallowed myself whole, took myself and myself from behind, For a while, she liked to watch it snake toward her across the floor, liked the way it coiled up a leg, then threaded the cleft of her rear, whipping around her waist, then back up her back, curling over her shoulder and back down between her breasts, down her stomach, parting her down, down there, and then her labia, and into her from above, how its tensile strength lifted her in this hardened harness, held her weightless as it expanded within her and all around her. We haven't done that in a while. And everything, everything, believe me, grows familiar. Recently, our lovemaking has tended toward the less baroque. A simple vertical embrace, my member remembering its scale from before the accident. Sue, her legs wrapped around my waist, is saddled on my hips, riding this altogether unfantastic appendage, and me supporting her, strapping my silly, pliant arms around her, and then around me, and then around her again, stretching another lap and lapping another lap, another band around us both, belting us to us, my arms still encircling, encasing us from head to toe, this cocoon spinning while we kiss, my elasticity nearing its end, effaced to the point of transparency, my thinning skin becoming at last the clear outer covering, at last, of this new creature we create. The Thing. I don't really need the briefs down below since my thing ain't there no more. It's more for show to let the folks know I was once a guy. A scrap of cloth for modesty of the citizens craning their necks to take a gander at me. They can't get past the orangey crust of skin. It's something, all right. Little do they know I am all hanging out there for anybody to see, my Johnson, or what I take to be my Johnson. Johnson's really, I don't know, since there's no other thing like me, as far as I can tell, to let me try out these doohickeys of wadded calluses and thingamabobs of oozing mucus. It's plopped right there in front of their collective noses. Just more eruptions and rashes on the sliding plates of my scaly surface. The doc explained it to me, showed me the tinker toy models of your typical twisted normal gene, and then how mine's been tripled, another worm squirming around the ladder of goofy golf balls. It's simple for everybody but me, male and female down to everybody's bones but me. No bones for me, no in and out, no on and off, a whole other dimension to Nookie. What I've become needs a couple other things to reproduce, I guess, not just one other. Sex, as near as I can figure, is like nothing you can dream of, since those dirty pictures your brain's pumping out are made up of, you got it, those same twin strands caught wrapped up in each other. Well, I am another other, and I'm on the lookout for other others like me. Meantime, when I'm alone, but this could be in the middle of Times freaking Square, a public spectacle where the public can't begin to see the me that's me, I make myself have this nameless thing. I feel this thing. I have no words, no more, for.
This is Jamming Their Transmission. I'm John Madera. You've been listening to Rose Hunter, Rebecca Entel, Paul Beckman, Davis Schneiderman, and Michael Martone. Thanks so much to all the writers for appearing on Jamming Their Transmission. That does it for our show. Thanks for listening to Jamming Their Transmission. I'm John Madera. Until next time, and always, be the strange you wish to see in the world.